and again. But in 1986, worried regulators ordered the SNL to stop funding, that's the San Jacinto Savings and Loan, to stop funding Southmark's purchases, and Phillips had to rely on another favored way to raise cash. That year, he raised $950 million through Drexel Burnham Lambert. In fact, much of Southmark's explosion in assets, according to SEC filings, was financed by junk bonds marketed for Phillips by his close friend Michael Milken, Drexel Burnham Lambert's junk bond king. Forbes reported Drexel Burnham Lambert made well over $50 million in fees by financing Southmark and its subsidiaries. When Phillips borrowed money, he took more than he needed and used the extra to invest in other companies' junk bonds being marketed by Milken, a common practice of many of Drexel Burnham's favorite customers. The practice bore a disturbing resemblance to the cash for trash deals where a thrift borrower was required to take more money than he wanted and to use the excess to buy a piece of junk property from the thrift. One year, the Wall Street Journal reported, Drexel raised $450 million for Southmark and Phillips used all of it to buy other junk bonds Drexel was promoting. Southmark became the largest real estate-based conglomerate financed by Milken. It may also have been one of the most complex. Even seasoned Wall Street analysts admitted to reporters they couldn't figure out the company's maze and layers of debt. What they did know, however, was that Southmark had a lot of debt coming due all at once in the early 1990s. So again, apparently much of Southmark's growth, and Southmark we're going to see in connection with many of the players in the CIA connection to the SNL crisis, much of Southmark's growth financed by junk bonds coming through Drexel Burnham Lambert and Drexel Burnham Lambert's junk bonds king, Michael Milken, a good friend of Southmark chairman Gene Phillips. Skipping down. We went back to our files and began compiling a list of Southmark's appearances. Time and time again, the company had turned up at the end of our investigation of a failed thrift. Southmark would appear most often in the role of scavenger, acquiring the troubled assets of those who had contributed to the failure of the institution. We had found, for example, Southmark or a Southmark subsidiary acquiring assets formerly owned by Mario Renda. Bear in mind, Mario Renda, key figure in the tangle of events surrounding Air Azima, also a person we're going to look at in connection with the Centennial Savings and Loan, the connecting link between the CIA-SNL connection and the drug tug case. Beginning again. We had found, for example, Southmark or a Southmark subsidiary acquiring assets formerly owned by Mario Renda, Robert Ferrante, Morris Schenker, John B. Anderson, and Tom Nevis. Now, many of these deals were further confirmed by Phillips' testimony before the Gaming Control Board. Southmark's Pratt Hotel Division acquired the Palace Hotel and Casino Project in Puerto Rico, which investigators told us was being developed by Mario Renda and Robert Ferrante until their empires crumbled. Once again, this is the precise nature of the relationship between Southmark and Renda. Southmark's Pratt Hotel Division acquired the Palace Hotel and Casino Project in Puerto Rico, whose investigators told us was being developed by Mario Renda and Robert Ferrante until their empires crumbled. Skipping down, Southmark's SNL subsidiary, San Jacinto Savings, got media attention when it tried to buy troubled Continental Savings in Houston. Beeb had bankrolled Carol Kelly and David Wiley in their purchase of Continental. And skipping down, then we found Southmark's fingerprints at Silverado Savings and Loan in Denver. Neil Bush, son of then-Vice President George Bush, became director on Silverado's board in 1985, but resigned just days after his father was nominated in 1988 as the Republican candidate for president, and just 3 months before Silverado was forced by regulators to establish nearly $200 million in loan loss reserves to cushion the thrift from expected losses on shaky deals. Neil Bush said he resigned for personal reasons. Others said his resignation was to spare his father the embarrassment of Silverado Savings' condition. Silverado collapsed in late 1988. After all, one of George Bush's jobs as vice president during Ronald Reagan's first term had been to chair the Bush Task Group on Regulation of Financial Services. The group was part of Ronald Reagan's deregulation apparatus. It died a quiet death in August of 1983 after accomplishing very little. Once again, it's worth noting here that the very deregulation of the saving of the SNLs, which permitted all of this to go on, was accomplished while George Bush was head of the Bush Task Group on Regulation of Financial Services. This last sentence again. Neil Bush said he resigned for personal reasons. Others said his resignation was to spare his father the embarrassment of Silverado Savings condition. Silverado collapsed in late 1988. After all, one of George Bush's jobs as vice president during Ronald Reagan's first term had been to chair the Bush Task Group on Regulation of Financial Services. The group was part of Ronald Reagan's deregulation apparatus. It died a quiet death in August of 1983 after accomplishing very little. After we had collected all of this information about Southmark, we asked ourselves what it meant that Southmark, a giant corporation, had turned up in investigations that we had thought at the outset were entirely unrelated. A disturbingly large number of our trails led to Southmark in one way or another. The company appeared to be a major player in the network of people we had been tracking, often there to pick up the pieces whenever one of our thrift pirates hit rough water. Apparently, someone else was wondering as well. When the Dallas Times-Herald printed the list of the 400 individuals whose records were subpoenaed by the Justice Department's Fraud Task Force in 1987, Gene Phillips was among them. Southmark itself began to show up on the business pages of daily newspapers as Phillips and Friedman were increasingly forced to deny that Southmark was in deep trouble. Its Houston thrift, San Jacinto, was put under a supervisory order in 1988 and forced to take almost $140 million in write-downs. Regulators forced Southmark to remove two of its three directors from San Jacinto's board, and in early 1989, under pressure from Southmark investors and directors, Phillips and Friedman resigned from their positions at Southmark. The Southmark puzzle was one of those black holes into which a reporter could disappear and never be heard from again. One normally reliable source even told us he had phone records showing that a real estate broker who had close dealings with both Southmark and Carlos Marcello had also made phone calls to Major General John Singlaub of Contragate fame. So the Southmark waters, in addition to some of the biggest names in high finance from the 1980s, also touches on some of the main political names from the 1980s, notably the Bush family, and we find tendrils leaping out as well, or reaching out as well, to people like Carlos Marcello, reputed capo mafioso for New Orleans, and another person named in the House Select Committee's investigation of the assassination of President Kennedy, and also, of course, to Major General John Singlaub, a key player in the World Anti-Communist League, also the Contra support effort, also a Christic Institute defendant. And again, we see connections here between Henry K. Beebe and Mario Renda and Southmark. And it's worth here perhaps going into the links between Southmark and the not only the Silverado Savings and Loan Milieu and MDC Holdings, but also we're going to take a look at Southmark's connection to Wayne Reeder, one of the Contra connections of the Silverado Milieu, along with Frank Corson, or one of the intelligence connections, I should say. Frank Corson, recall the associate of Lawrence Freeman, a reputed CIA operative. Wayne Reeder, also directly connected to the Contra support effort. Now, of Southmark and its connection to Silverado Savings and Loan, the main connection here is MDC Holdings, and in turn, MDC's chairman, Larry Mizell, a key Neil Bush associate. Again, reading a footnote here from Inside Job. Southmark's involvement at Silverado was through its subsidiary construction company, J.M. Peters, and another Colorado company, MDC Holdings, Incorporated. The two had been involved in an acquisition deal which, had it been completed, would have allowed Southmark to book a much-needed $25 million profit. Instead, the deal fell apart. MDC Holdings, Incorporated was another junk bond junkie, having sold $700 million worth through Drexel Burnham Lambert. The Denver Post reported that its chairman, Larry Mizell, lobbied in Washington on behalf of Drexel's junk bond operation. The Post described Mizell as one of Colorado's most powerful businessmen. By the end of 1988, MDC Holdings, whose affairs were intricately involved with those of Silverado Savings, was suffering severe losses and trying to regroup. So basically, again, a key connection here, MDC and Southmark MDC, one of the main connections to the Silverado orbit, as we looked at it in the March 11th, 1990 article from the Houston Post. Now, of Southmark's connection to Wayne Reeder, recall that Wayne Reeder connected to a scheme to manufacture weapons for the Contras on an Indian reservation that, in partnership with self-described CIA operative Dr. John Nichols, we looked at that in our last installment. In a footnote on the same page, the try authors of Inside Job add, G. Wayne Reeder, by the way, is R-E-E-D-E-R. Reeder ran Carlsberg Management, a former subsidiary of Carlsberg Corporation, which 10Ks and Reeder said was a subsidiary of Southmark. Federal investigators told us Reeder was associated with John Boretta, B-O-R-E-T-A, a business partner of casino owner John B. Anderson. So, again, the connection there between Southmark and Wayne Reeder. Now, Wayne Reeder and Mario Renda, a fellow who we've looked at in connection with Air Azima, recall an associate of, among others, Adnan Khashoggi, a person associated with Global and with the failure of the Indian State Springs Bank. We have also looked at Mario Renda and Wayne Reeder in connection with the failure of San Marino Savings. Now, reviewing that connection again, recall a point that I made last week. One of the potential greatest points of confusion here is also one of the potential greatest points of understanding, and that is the huge number of names that are involved, some of the same elements and people. Although it gets dizzying to try and keep a lot of these names straight, at the same time, when you keep seeing the same names and elements cropping up in connection with so many of these different scams, it's pretty obvious that we're not looking at a coincidence, anything but. Now, of the intersection between Mario Renda and G. Wayne Reeder, one of the contra connections of the Silverado orbit we looked at, of their connection to the San Marino failure, the try authors write as follows in Inside Job. One of the companies named in the 1987 indictment against Beebe and Wolf was League Incorporated. We thought there was something familiar about that name. We checked with Cage, and sure enough, at one time a Southern California developer, G. Wayne Reeder, had discussed becoming a partner in League Incorporated. We looked in our files and found a League Incorporated document with Reeder's signature on it right next to Beebe's. In fact, said Beebe's former right-hand man, Dale Anderson, Beebe and Reeder had tried to do several deals together. Herman must have run into Reeder while staying down at La Costa, Anderson said. Both men had homes at La Costa. We had run into Reeder often ourselves, beginning months earlier during our investigation of San Marino Savings in San Marino, California. San Marino, one of the first thrifts we ran into, beginning once again, San Marino, one of the first thrifts where we ran into Mario Renda, failed in late 1984. So Reeder, part of the Silverado orbit, also in one of their intelligence connections, one of the people in the Silverado orbit directly connected to the intelligence community, also involved with Mario Renda in the failure of the San Marino Savings. And again, I'm simply noting as many different points of intersection of these various elements as I can here. Now, remember Mario Renda, because we're the next item, we're going to take a musical break here, and then we're going to come to the Centennial Savings and Loan failure. And Mario Renda is one of the main links between the milieu that we've looked at so far, the Centennial Savings and Loan failure, and people figuring in the drug tug case. More in a minute. Well, good evening. Welcome once again to One Step Beyond. We're going to continue now. And let me also remind you now that we are going to be proceeding with our discussion of the CIA connection to the SNL crisis, and specifically, we're going to be talking about the Centennial Savings and Loan failure, which represents an intersection, or is the point of intersection, between the CIA connection to the SNL crisis and the drug tug case. And one of the main names unifying or linking the Centennial Savings and Loan to the milieu that we have been looking at this evening is the aforementioned Mario Renda. Now, that's the same Mario Renda we took a look at in our February 8, 1990 article about Farhad Azima and Global International Airways. We also saw him in another article from February 8th of 1990, and he's mentioned in connection with the failure of the Empire Savings and Loan, along with Wordy Jack Thompson. We looked at that in the last installment. Now, Mario Renda was one of the key people involved in brokering deposits and helping to finance the growth of the, or consequently helping to finance the growth of the Centennial Savings and Loan, excuse me, and it is the failure of the Centennial Savings and Loan that we're going to be looking at right now. Returning once again to the book Inside Job, the looting of America's Savings and Loans by Pizzo, Fricker, and Muolo, and again, don't mispronounce Mary Fricker's name, of the failure of Centennial and the role of the aforementioned Mario Renda in that, we're going to begin the discussion as follows. Now, by the way, Piombo here is a construction corporation purchased by Centennial Savings and Loan. Some of the money that Centennial found came through Mario Renda. When Pizzo asked Irv, that's Irv Hansen, one of the key players in Centennial Savings and Loan, when Pizzo asked Irv where Centennial was getting the $13 million in cash to buy Piombo, Hansen waved his hand in the air and brushed the question off by stating that the money was, quote, brokered deposits from the East Coast and from the Bureau of Indian Affairs, unquote. Skipping down, when Hansen told Pizzo he was using brokered deposits from the East Coast, unquote, to purchase Piombo Corporation, that's P-I-O-M-B-O, by the way, Pizzo understood. But Hansen's Bureau of Indian Affairs comment, which Hansen wouldn't clarify, left Pizzo baffled for 5 years. Finally, one day in 1988, after we were well along in our investigation of savings and loans elsewhere, we received a thick, unmarked package from an attorney on the East Coast. The contents of the package had nothing to do with Centennial. They related instead to Mario Renda, an East Coast deposit broker who was placing deposits at Centennial. But they provided the clue that enabled us to piece together the Bureau of Indian Affairs puzzle. Once again, the contents of the package had nothing to do with Centennial. They related instead to Mario Renda, an East Coast deposit broker who was placing deposits at Centennial. But they provided the clue that enabled us to piece together the Bureau of Indian Affairs puzzle. Skipping down, the BIA at that time managed $1.7 billion for American Indians. The Bureau was required by law to invest the money with government-insured institutions by purchasing short-term CDs, but as often as several times a week, they notified brokers that they had money to invest. Brokers served as middlemen, searching the nation for institutions offering the highest interest rate on short-term CDs on the day the BIA money became available for investment. Brokers placing funds for the BIA were paid a commission from the institution that received the BIA deposits. There was fierce competition among brokers for the BIA money, and in depositions taken in the Fort Leavenworth prisoners case in 1985, a deposit broker told the court it was his understanding that bribes to BIA officials in exchange for deposits were a routine business expense for deposit brokers. Since the SNLs paying the highest interest rate on deposits were the SNLs that were so desperate for money that they were willing to pay whatever it took to get it, this process put government in the position of rewarding, i.e. pouring money into, the nation's weakest financial institutions. For this reason, regulators in Washington vehemently opposed the use of deposit brokers by managers of government trust funds. Their opposition centered on the BIA fund because it was the largest government trust fund, but when they tried to halt the investment practice, they ran up against the political opposition of a tough lobby, the Indian lobby, which naturally enough wanted to get the highest possible return on its investments. FHLBB Chairman Ed Gray complained bitterly during this time that the BIA was channeling much of its deposit business to the country's weakest thrifts. He said that the BIA had funds in practically every thrift that had recently failed. We know now where Centennial got the fuel to power its enormous growth, from deposit broker Mario Renda and the money changers handling deposits for the BIA Trust Fund. There was enough money out there to feed hundreds of Centennials. So Mario Renda, again, a key player with the Centennial Savings and Loan failure. And he's one of the individuals, again, who links the Centennial Savings and Loan to the operations that we've been looking at before. We've looked at him again in connection with the Empire Savings, in connection with Air Azima, Global International Airways, the Indian State Springs Bank, etc. Now we're going to take a look at Irv Hansen. He's the fellow who was one of the key players in the Centennial Savings and Loan case. We're going to look at what happened to him as federal investigators were looking into the Centennial Savings and Loan case. And we're also going to take a look at Sid Shaw, the developer who was one of the people who was very much involved with Irwin Hansen, or Irv Hansen, as he's known, with developing the Centennial Savings and Loan. One of the key names here is Peter Robinson, the U.S. attorney, who was investigating, or perhaps the word allegedly investigating, the Centennial Savings and Loan situation. He's the fellow who's focusing federal attention on Irwin Hansen. Returning again to Inside Job. Investigators said they hoped that, once faced with the sobering reality of a multi-count grand jury indictment and years in prison, Hansen would give them the evidence against Sid Shaw. Nice idea, and it might have worked, except that time ran out for the FBI when on July 30th, 1987, 2 years after the feds took over Centennial and just one day before Hanson was to enter into negotiations with the Justice Department, Hanson, 55, was found stone dead in bed. Nearly everyone suspected suicide or foul play, so the coroner gave the case special attention. The official report? Hanson had died of a cerebral aneurysm. A blood vessel on the right side of his brain had burst while he slept. Now, we looked into that. This particular passage was read into the record, into the archives, in our last installment. But there is more going on here with the this particular passage. We're going to extend the reading of this particular passage, and we're going to take a look at what happened with Sid Shaw when he was indicted. We're going to take a look at Sid Shaw and his indictment on a drug smuggling charge, and we're going to take a look at a hash, marijuana, and cocaine smuggling operation curiously reminiscent of and perhaps connected to the drug tug case. Continuing with Inside Job, a pall fell over the sordid Centennial story after Hanson's death. Shaw was the only major player left unscathed. He had boasted in the newspapers through his high-powered lawyer that he was guilty of nothing more than taking advantage of good business opportunities. Sure, he'd made a lot of money. What was wrong with that? But quietly, behind the scenes, the multi-agency investigation into the December 1982 fire on Lower Ridge Road had continued. Then, suddenly, on October 5, 1987, Special Agents Pat Murphy and Ernie Cooper met Sid Shaw after he was leaving his Sonoma, California home, the opulent Spreckles Mansion of sugar fame, and hauled him off to appear before a federal magistrate in San Francisco. The grand jury had indicted Shaw, accusing him of being part of an elaborate $300 million international drug smuggling and money laundering operation that imported marijuana, hashish, and cocaine from Mexico, Morocco, Colombia, and Thailand, and that had done the bulk of its business between 1979 and 1985. Shaw denied the charges. The ring was headed, the indictment said, by Ronald Stevenson, alias Ronald Miller, who had lived at the expensive Lower Ridge Road house with his wife and child at the time it was torched. Investigators speculated he had since been murdered in Mexico. Sid Shaw indicted, roared the headlines. Santa Rosa buzzed with the news. By the way, this is the drug smuggling operation, which is similar. It sounds similar to the drug tug case. One of the things I'm wondering about, obviously interrupting the discussion here, is whether or not after the Centennial Savings operation failed, whether perhaps the drug tug case, the Lenvest Corporation, was brought in to help launder the money from this operation. This might be two completely different operations, or it might be the same operation. I'm not sure which. And again, it's a question I'm asking here. And just as we asked the question about whether or not the savings and loans were taking the place of the Nugent Hand Bank in terms of laundering money for the mob and the CIA and other related elements, just as, according to Jonathan Quitney, Nugent Hand took the place of the Castle Bank, set up by Paul Helliwell, and to a certain extent in cooperation with Lawrence Freeman, its counsel, one of the questions we might ask here is whether or not the Lenvest Corporation, in turn, supplanted Centennial Savings and Loan as one of the institutions involved with, apparently, this ring. Certainly, Sid Shaw of Centennial was indicted with this particular ring. Certainly suggests that perhaps Centennial as a whole was one of the institutions that this ring was dipping into. In any event, more about Sid Shaw and his indictment on marijuana, hash, and cocaine charges. Sid Shaw indicted, roared the headlines. Santa Rosa buzzed with the news. The indictment, drafted by the Federal Organized Crime Drug Enforcement Task Force, charged that Shaw, Las Vegas attorney Norman Jensen, and others had learned of the drug proceeds through a complex web of real estate projects, including some connected to Centennial Savings and Loan and Piombo Corporation. At Shaw's bail hearing, a prosecutor cited Shaw's recent trips to Amsterdam to meet with Sandman as reason to fear that Shaw might flee if released from jail before the trial. Nevertheless, by the way, Nicholas Sandman is one of the jet-setters involved with Centennial. Nevertheless, the judge ordered Shaw released on $500,000 bail. The case was pending as of this writing. Unbeknownst to Shaw, during the lengthy inquiry, federal investigators had secretly recorded a meeting and phone calls between Shaw, Norm Jensen, and Ronald Stevenson's brother, Michael. Shaw, Jensen, and Stevenson discussed ways to best deal with the grand jury, which had subpoenaed records of their complex real estate transactions. The transcript of the meeting showed Shaw reassuring the others. You don't have to worry about me saying anything. Where the money was coming from, don't worry about that part of it. Anything, if anything, could hurt you guys. One more time. You don't have to worry about me saying anything. Where the money was coming from, don't worry about that part. If anything, could hurt you guys. Unquote. Members of the drug ring began to talk, and transcripts of the interrogations showed they told investigators that Norman Jensen, the man who had done millions of dollars worth of business with Piombo, was at the very center of a high-rolling international drug operation. One informant, William Orloff Henriksen, told the FBI that Jensen had, quote, mob affiliations, unquote. A confidential DEA source said Jensen owned his own freighter, which prowled the waters from South America to Oregon. The informant told investigators that Jensen complained that the freighter was stuck in South America because it was being watched by the feds and that Jensen was willing to pay $1 million to anyone who would pilot it back to the United States. Transcripts showed investigators were also told that Jensen held drug kingpin Ron Stevenson's property in his name and in the names of various shell corporations, and that Jensen used his own Coos Bay, Oregon marina as an importation point for millions of dollars worth of pot and cocaine. An FBI agent said he was told Jensen had placed the drug ring's vast fortune in safe havens in Switzerland, the Bahamas, Panama, and Thailand, once with the help of a Swiss consul general, and once with the help of a Thai embassy employee in Los Angeles. Those same areas, by the way, interrupting here, are some of the same areas we see involved with the drug tug case. Also, some of the same areas that were some of Paul Helliwell's favorite stomping grounds, interestingly enough. Proceeding here. One technique used by Jensen to launder all this high-temperature money, a source in prison told us, was to purchase expensive property with a cash down payment and take out as large a loan as possible on the property. Jensen could then make the monthly payments on the loan with drug proceeds. The interest he paid on the loan, he simply considered to be the cost of cleaning the money, the laundry bill. Jensen associates, including Henriksen and Michael Stevenson, told investigators that 50% of the Lakewood Hills development had been financed by Stevenson's drug proceeds. How much did the ring launder through Lakewood Hills? An investigator asked Henriksen. $500 million at Lakewood Hills, I think, he replied. That's what he, Ronald Stevenson, told me one time. $500,000, unquote. A county politician had eased the paperwork for the Lakewood Hills development through the county bureaucracy, he added. They had the politician in their pocket, one of them, you know, and they could get permits through him and expletive deleted like that. Later, Centennial bought Lakewood Hills, thereby cashing out the asset for Jensen and the others. A raid on Jensen's office in Las Vegas netted investigators a treasure trove of documentation on Jensen's far-flung enterprises. An inventory of items taken in that search included paperwork on various real estate transactions allegedly used to launder drug money, including files on Lakewood Hills and Jensen's deals with Piombo Corporation, and numerous plastic bags and bottles containing, quote, green leafy substances and white powders and white powder residues, according to the FBI receipt for property received. With such damning evidence in federal hands, Jensen agreed to cooperate with the government in its investigation of the drug ring. Sid Shaw and individuals at Savings and Loans in Texas, Washington, and Louisiana. Beginning of one, let me read that last sentence again. There's an editing mistake here. With such damning evidence in federal hands, Jensen agreed to cooperate with the government in its investigation of the drug ring, Sid Shaw, and individuals at Savings and Loans in Texas, Washington, and Louisiana. In return, Jensen sought and received partial immunity from prosecution. Then, just before the drug trial was scheduled to begin, informant Michael Stevenson disappeared. The drug case was pending as this book went to press. Now, the main names here, again, bear in mind there may be no connection here between this and the drug tug case, but it's interesting to see that we have intersections between some of the same players in the Centennial failure and in the drug tug case, and also intersections between some of the people, notably Sid Shaw, in the Centennial failure and a very similar type of operation here. So bear in mind the name Sid Shaw, the main Centennial link to this situation. Now we're going to take a look at the assistant U.S. attorney who was involved with overseeing the Centennial investigation. Continuing with the passage here from Inside Job. At this point, the wind went out of the Centennial criminal investigation. The Fed's technique of sweating out Hansen had blown up in their faces, and now that he was dead, Assistant U.S. Attorney Peter Robinson announced he was going into private practice to become a defense attorney, and the FBI had to scale back its investigation. After 12 years as a federal prosecutor, Robinson would now defend clients accused of some of the same kinds of crimes he had formerly prosecuted. In an article he wrote for a legal publication, he said his new clientele gave him something he had not found as a prosecutor, quoting, "The feeling I have experienced as a defense lawyer getting a dismissal for a client is euphoric and addicting. The gratitude for helping one real person is much greater than I received as a prosecutor helping the public. My days as a champion of the underdog have just begun. It is a daunting challenge, but I already feel at home." In a final twist of irony, Robinson revealed that his new offices would be located in Centennial's former executive quarters, the Stone House. So Peter Robinson, immediately after the Centennial investigation folds, goes to work defending some of the same people he had been allegedly investigating, moves into Centennial's old offices, and as we shall see, he begins illegally representing someone from the drug tug case, namely Charles Duck, the LenVest bankruptcy trustee. He was illegally representing him because he had been involved, or his office, I should say, the office out of which Robinson worked, had been involved in an investigation with Charles Duck begun while Robinson was there, and Robinson did not wait the requisite 2 years before representing Charles Duck. Now, again, the question I'm asking is whether or not Centennial and perhaps LenVest are connected, and whether perhaps there is a connection between the drug tug ring and this drug smuggling ring that was linked with Sid Shaw of the Centennial Savings and Loan. As I like to say so often, FFT, GFFR, food for thought, grounds for further research. We are now going to take a musical break, and then we're going to come back and review Peter Robinson, Charles Duck, Drug Tug Case Part 4 and Part after a musical break. Well, good evening. Welcome back once again to One Step Beyond. Bear in mind now the information about the Centennial Savings and Loan, and bear in mind that one of its prime creators was Mario Renda, one of the people who we find in connection with Arizima, Southmark, and so many of the elements cropping up in connection with the CIA connection to the SNL crisis. Bear in mind Sid Shaw. Bear in mind the marijuana, hashish, and cocaine smuggling ring, touching many of the same bases, notably Thailand, Panama, and Switzerland, that we see in the drug tug case. We're now going to take a look at U.S. Attorney Peter Robinson, the person who immediately after the Centennial failure went to work representing, among others, Charles Duck. And we're going to take a look at Charles Duck, his role, his connections to, I should say, the drug tug LenVest case. And we're going to take a look at the connections of Charles Duck to specifically Centennial Savings and Loan. What we're going to do right now is we're going to listen to part four of the drug tug case. For those of you not familiar with the drug tug case, a summary will begin this particular section. And we apologies to those of you who find this overly repetitive, but again, with this tangle of connections, and it literally goes around in circles, I think repetition here is essential for helping to keep in mind some of these elements. So here is part four of the drug tug case. Now, in a nutshell, the drug tug LenVest case is a case that broke in the late spring of 1988, and which appears to involve yet another CIA and national security-related drug smuggling operation in order to finance the Contras. Now, in a nutshell, the drug tug LenVest case comes out as follows. Basically, a fellow named Calvin Robinson, who was arrested for bringing pushing a barge full of marijuana and hashish into San Francisco Bay in 1988. Upon his arrest, he claimed to be working for the CIA, and as it turned out, he was connected with a number of interesting people. In the first place, he had direct connections to the Medellin cartel, the Colombian cocaine cartel, which was intimately involved with the Iran-Contra scandal, and we went into that in Radio Free America show program number 29 and came back to it again in shows 33 and 34 and supplements. In addition to being connected with the Medellin cartel, he was also connected with some individuals known as Thurston, Russell, and Wobser. Robert Russell, Earl Patrick Thurston, and I've forgotten what Mr. Wobser's first name was offhand, but in any event, Earl Patrick Thurston was connected with AmerWest Airlines Incorporated, the vice president specifically, that was identified in the Napa Sentinel as a CIA air proprietary. Beyond that, Messrs. Russell and Wobser flew for Air America for the CIA during the Vietnam War. And when they came to trial, their attorney offered up what you could say was a national security defense. He claimed that the airplane full of marijuana, which they were convicted of bringing into the country, was in fact filled with arms, and this was being used to finance the Contras. As far as I know, that case is still pending. That's one end of the thing. That's Calvin Robinson. His ties to not only the Medellin cartel, but also to Mr. Earl Patrick Thurston, Wobser, and Russell, all with CIA connections, specifically CIA air proprietaries. Now, another main branch of this particular connection has to do with a Napa, Costa Rica branch. Now, a number of businesses in Napa, notably the Lenvest Company, which we're going to be going into in a few minutes, as well as Joseph Matthews Winery and some other institutions, appear to have been involved with the financial angles, the financial scams, which lay at the money end of the drug tug operation. Now, the main names to know here are Dr. John Duff, last name D-U-F-F, and Kenneth Armitage, A-R-M-I-T-A-G-E. Now, these two people were involved, the two main names, involved with an island called the Drug Island, or Isla Jesucita. This island is just off the coast of Costa Rica. It was described as being operated on behalf of General Noriega of Panama, himself very much involved with the CIA and the Contra support effort, and specifically John Duff and Kenneth Armitage are the two main names involved with the technical proprietorship of the Drug Tug Island. That is a telescoping of the actual, or the drug island, I should say, Isla Jesucita. That's a telescoping of the situation because, in fact, the ownership was very, very complicated. There was a deliberately confusing revolving ownership scheme. But the two main names who presided over the Isla Jesucita were Dr. John Duff, last name D-U-F-F, and Kenneth Armitage, last name A-R-M-I-T-A-G-E. Now, they, in turn, were involved not only with Noriega in this island, but also with John Hull, one of the main defendants in the Christic Institute's lawsuit, and also a person named by the Costa Rican legislature as one of the people involved with the Costa Rican end of the drug traffic used to support the Contras. Now, John Duff specifically lived on John Hull's ranch for a while and was a business partner with John Hull. Isla Jesucita was used as a transit point for guns and drugs in the revolving Arms for Drugs Contra support operation. Kenneth Armitage also ran a phony passport scheme, or a bogus passport scheme, in Costa Rica. Kenneth Armitage was in England. He agreed to roll over in exchange for limited immunity from prosecution and in exchange for being allowed to hang on to some of the profits from this operation. But before he could roll over, before he could turn state's evidence, he died under mysterious circumstances. One of the many people who died under mysterious circumstances in this particular case. In addition, another fascinating connection involves let me also tell you that Dr. John Duff, whether or not this is significant, was also a business partner in the Vallejo Medical Building with Dr. Howard Lonsdale, who was the fellow who rented the Aryan Nation skinheads, the property up in Napa, for the abortive Aryan Woodstock. That was a case that had a tremendous amount of press here in the Bay Area. They were going to have a racist Woodstock with some Nazi punk bands. That never came off. In fact, there were more counter-demonstrators than participants, although it did serve as something of a PR coup for the Nazis because the demonstrators did not comport themselves with a great deal of decorum, and in my opinion, they actually did their cause more harm and actually benefited the Nazis, perhaps without meaning to. In any event, that is certainly interesting, perhaps significant, although perhaps apocryphal. Bear in mind the Dr. John Duff, Howard Lonsdale connection and Lonsdale's connections to these Aryan Nations and neo-Nazi activities. Whether or not that is significant remains to be determined. Frequently, the National Security Establishment has used neo-Nazi elements at the operation level in various types of covert operations. Now, it's worth noting also that there is a connection between Calvin Robinson and Christopher Boyce, the person convicted of spying for the Soviet Union. Boyce is the main figure, along with Andrew Dalton Lee in The Falcon and the Snowman, a book by Robert Lindsay of the New York Times, which was made into a major motion picture a few years ago. Now, interestingly enough, Calvin Robinson, when in jail on an earlier conviction, shared a jail cell with Christopher Boyce, and 5 days after Robinson's release, Boyce escaped from prison. He rendezvoused with Robinson in Santa Cruz. They planned bank robberies together. And so there's a very strong link between Boyce and Calvin Robinson. Beyond that, it's interesting to note that the defense used by Andrew Dalton Lee, who was Robinson's partner, Christopher Boyce's partner in this Soviet spy scam, claimed basically that he was involved in a CIA disinformation campaign, deliberately leaking outdated and therefore useless information to the Soviets in exchange for getting their confidence in a counterintelligence sting. Andrew Dalton Lee claims he was left out in the cold, and given the intersection between his partner on all of these other activities, that certainly is not something that should be dismissed out of hand. And we're going to begin with more information this evening on the Calvin Robinson-Christopher Boyce connection. Specifically, we're going to take a look at information that, in fact, the bank robberies that they planned may have been pulled off. We'll talk about that in a little bit. Then we're going to introduce a new player in this scenario, and it's a very important name, and that is a fellow named Charles Duck, last name D-U-C-K, just like in the waterfowl. And Charles Duck was the trustee for the LendVest Corporation, the mortgage company that was involved with the financial end of this whole thing. It was one of the firms used for laundering money and for gaining working capital for this. Charles Duck was the LendVest trustee when the company went bankrupt, and he's an interesting person. He obtained a very interesting leniency agreement from the U.S. Attorney's Office in San Francisco, and then it turned out that not only did he receive this leniency agreement in exchange for pleading guilty to embezzlement, but also his attorney, a fellow named Peter Robinson, had previously worked as an assistant U.S. attorney under Joseph Russignello in San Francisco, the person with whom, the U.S. attorney with whom this agreement was worked out. He had begun representing Charles Duck less than 2 years after leaving the U.S. attorney's office. That is illegal. Beyond that, it later emerged that Peter Robinson represents a fellow named Bercera, allegedly connected with the very same Medellin cartel, which figures in the Contra support effort and which also figures quite obviously with Calvin Robinson and the drug tug case. Beyond that, Peter Robinson also represents a fellow named David Dixon of the LendVest case. And as I said, he had previously worked under Joseph Russignello in the U.S. Attorney's Office, about whom we're going to have more to say later. Now, as mentioned, it is illegal for Peter Robinson to have been representing Charles Duck in this case since he had left the U.S. Attorney's Office less than 2 years before and before representing a private client in such a case. According to U.S. law, there have to be at least 2 years of elapsed time. They were not in this particular situation. Then, the web continues to grow more tangled. There was a report in the Napa Sentinel, which appears to have been confirmed now, that Charles Duck... Again, don't confuse Charles Duck with John Duff, who in turn is hooked up with John Hull, because this can get confusing. But Charles Duck apparently flew down to Costa Rica to hook up with John Duff, who in turn is an associate of John Hull. This later apparently was confirmed, but when Harry Martin of the Napa Sentinel went to get a hold of the air manifest for this flight, apparently that is now not obtainable because it has been subpoenaed by a U.S. congressional committee looking into U.S. complicity in the drug trade. More will be seen about that in a minute. After that, we're going to take a short musical break and come back with three articles which appear to be related, or at least involve the same milieu. Whether or not they're directly related to the drug tug case remains to be seen. But interestingly enough, we're going to review an article from the San Francisco Examiner last May, which sets forth allegations of working connections between elements of the San Francisco Police Department and... surprise, surprise, the Medellin cartel. After that, we're going to look at a very interesting recent case, or a recent development in which Al Melder left the San Francisco Police Commission and was replaced by the chief prosecutor for Oliver North, which is interesting. I don't know too much about the man, but at the very least, we can say he sure prosecuted the hell out of Ollie North, didn't he? And beyond that, we're going to take a look at an interesting and nauseating development in which the former CIA station chief in Costa Rica, Joseph Fernandez, was recently had charges dismissed against him. We're going to take a look at that, speculate about whether or not might in some ways relate to the drug tug LendVest case. And we're going to take a look at some interesting observations on the Fernandez verdict by none other than G. Robert Blakey, former chief counsel to the House Select Committee on Assassinations, who helped cover up that investigation. And we're going to take a look at the extent to which this particular bird has not changed his feathers. So that basically is what we have on tap for this, the third update of the drug tug LendVest case.